Hello and welcome back to Clinicians Brief, the podcast, the conversations behind the content. I'm your host, Dr. Alyssa Watson, and today I'm talking with one of our favorite veteran authors and podcast guests, Dr. Lisa Pullman. Dr. Pullman recently joined us to discuss tips and tricks for getting diagnostic fine needle biopsy samples. But today, we're going to switch gears a little and talk about a very interesting case of Trichomonas fetus infection in a shelter cat. The article that inspired this discussion can be found in the March 2021 edition of Clinician's Brief, and it's entitled Watery Diarrhea and Frequent Fecal Dribbling in a Cat. Thanks so much for joining us again today, Dr. Pullman.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me.
So for those of us at home that may not have caught your previous episodes, could you introduce yourself again and share a bit about your background?
Sure. So I graduated from the Ontario Veterinary College at the University of Guelph in 2001. After 3 years of small animal practice, I then went to Auburn University in Alabama for a residency and master's degree in clinical pathology. And then in 2007, I became a diplomat of the American College of Veterinary Pathologists and then joined the Kansas State University faculty as a clinical pathologist here. So I'm currently an associate professor. I was ClinPath director. Lab director here for 8 years, and then recently moved more to a teaching focus role. I'm also very involved in community service and shelter medicine, and am currently serving as president and medical director of our local humane society, which is actually important in my role in this case, but I've been doing that for 9 years.
Wow, you wear a lot of hats.
Yes, I do.
Well, I'm really excited to talk about this case. So, you know, as a practicing practitioner, you know, general practitioner, I love these case-based articles because they're really practical learning tools and they really help me connect theory to practice. And so this case in particular, I felt demonstrated the importance of getting a really accurate diagnosis because the cat in question in this case was relinquished to the shelter due to her chronic diarrhea. So can you tell our audience about the cat's history, and how you did become involved in her case?
Yeah. So an approximately one-year-old, intact, female, domestic medium hair cat. She was relinquished to our Humane Society. And she had been owned for approximately 1 month after being found as a stray. And she was very, very friendly, had clearly been handled by people prior to being found. And this is an important point just when we talk about the diagnosis more later and such, but just the fact that she was a stray, I think she hadn't probably been out as a stray very long, just because we don't tend to see this disease in stray or feral animals. And so I think just regard to that may be a point that we bring up later. So the big problem that was already mentioned here was her, and her reason for being relinquished is that she had chronic diarrhea, and then the frequent fecal dribbling and incontinence was really what the owner really couldn't tolerate. And she did not resolve, or this diarrhea did not resolve with a 5-day course of fenbendazole. I just want to say that this person that did relinquish her really cared about her, but she was a student. She didn't have a lot of means to get the appropriate care, and she was living in a rental with other people. So, you know, I know it's sometimes people are quick to judge about relinquishing, but sometimes, you know, they just don't feel that they can give the appropriate care. And so on intake to the Humane Society, she went through her testing, you know, the routine testing for FIV and FELV, and it was negative. She was vaccinated and treated with selamectin. And then there was diarrhea on arrival in her carrier. And so that sample was collected and then sent for a routine fecal float and assessment for Giardia antigen. And so no parasites were seen and no antigen was detected on the Giardia SNAP test. So I got involved the following day as the veterinarian. I'm the one that examined her. On examination, she was bright, alert, responsive. She had normal vital signs. She was thin, so she had a body condition score of about 3 out of 9. And what really actually made the case in the sense of getting something that was resulting in this publication was that during that examination, she had this very small amount of sort of slightly brown-tinged watery fluid that dribbled from her anus. So I got, you know, really excited, like, ooh, we need that. And then took a wet mount sample of that and also did a smear, you know, an air dried smear immediately. So on the wet mount preparation, it was one of those cases that you call everybody over and you say, oh my goodness, look at this. Because what we saw were these abundant motile organisms, and they were exhibiting this sort of erratic but forward progressive motion. And so then on the air dried stain smear, we, you know, saw a variety of bacteria, which is, you know, consistent with the feces and debris, but then also these protozoal organisms that were really quite well preserved. And they exhibited the three anterior flagella and a posterior flagella, a nucleus, the undulating membrane. And so all of this was consistent with a Trichomonas fetus, which is the presumptive diagnosis.
It's funny how excited we get over a little bit of feces or a little bit of urine, right? When yeah. we're like, oh good, we can put this on a slide. So as you said, this cat, you diagnosed her with Trichomonas fetus. And a lot of us familiar with this organism know that it does look a little bit like Giardia, a lot like Giardia. But I think you had kind of alluded to the fact that they have a very different motion, you know, on the slide. So even though they look similar, that's one way that we can differentiate them. Is that correct?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, there is both different morphology and different motility between the adult Giardia and the Trichomonads. So when you identify that you have motile trophozoites on a wet mount, really you have to differentiate them between Trichomonads and Giardia. And I'm actually going to mention two Trichomonads, but Trichomonads, generally, they can be identified by, as I mentioned, this rapid forward progressive motility that is kind of erratic, but it's got that definite forward progressive motility. And Giardia does not exhibit this motion. So with Giardia, we describe it more like leaves falling from a tree pattern. There is a really great video on Jody Gookin's website. She's really the guru on Trichomonas fetus. And if you go to her website, she's at NC State and she's got the laboratory there, but you can identify, and it's handy, you know, if you're in practice and you're wondering about, you know, this motility and trying to differentiate it, you can go there and then look at this video, and it nicely shows the differences. So again, so we're trying to differentiate the Trichomonads and Giardia. The significance of the differentiating Trichomonads, I said there's two, so both will have this progressive forward motility. One is Trichomonas fetus, which is really the most important one, but the other is Pentatrichomonas hominis, and then we can do that via light microscopy generally, just by counting the anterior flagella. So just moving then, did I answer well the motility question?
Yes.
Before I move to the... Okay, yes. So I just want to make sure before I move on to the light microscopy. So with regard to light microscopy, Giardia, it's this binucleate kind of pear-shaped organism that has the four flagella. But the thing that I think everybody notices about Giardia, it's kind of like this smiley face looking up at you. You know, it's kind of symmetrical. And so you can see those two nuclei staring up at you. With the Trichomonads, you know, I've already explained the anterior flagella and the posterior flagella. It's got this undulating membrane that you can usually see if they're well preserved. It's just got one nucleus. And then to differentiate the Pentatrichomonas hominis and the Trichomonas fetus, you just count the anterior flagella. And again, differentiating these, really the significance being that Pentatrichomonas hominis is believed to be non-pathogenic. It's a commensal organism, and it's really not that significant pathologically, but it has been reported to be an etiologic agent for chronic diarrhea in cats and immunosuppressed cats specifically. So very rare as a pathologic agent. So really what we're thinking about is Trichomonas fetus. I don't know if gone into all that, but I just wanted to point that out. So is that okay?
Yeah, that's great. That's really, I had never heard of that. So that's very interesting. So there are some fecal analysis techniques as well, you know, beyond the smear, fecal culture and PCR that are used to diagnose Trichomonas fetus. Can you talk a little bit about the pros and cons of those different analyses techniques?
Yeah, so microscopy is the one, obviously, this is the easiest one, the most rapid one. You can do it in your practice. So you've got the wet mount and then, you know, cytology, you've got the air-dried smear. So least expensive. The problem is with this, it is the one that has the lowest sensitivity. Okay, so if you don't see anything, it really doesn't mean that the animal is negative. But again, it's something you should do. It's quick, it's fast. The specificity, if you do see something, again, the importance is to make sure it's you're not mistaking the Trichomonas or the trichomonads with other organisms. So I think, you know, always that is something that, you know, you can go ahead and do, especially if you really do need fresh feces. In fact, very fresh feces. Then there is a culture, which is an in-pouch test, and you can buy these pouches. This is, again, something that you can do in practice. And so then you can check these pouches every 48 hours, you know, for even up to 12 days. I think that that's what many of the parasitology labs do that have these pouches. And the sensitivity is certainly a lot better, about 55%. And the cost is, again, relatively minimal, but it takes longer. You're waiting for this culture to occur, for these organisms to proliferate. Not 100% at all specific. Again, although this does not support the growth of Giardia, it will support Pentatrichomonas hominis. Again, Pentatrichomonas hominis is not a significant pathogen, but we want to differentiate it from Trichomonas fetus to be specifically knowing what we're treating. Okay, so that's with regard to the culture. Now, PCR is the gold standard test. And so this is going to be, though, significantly more expensive. It really varies on the cost, depending on the lab that you use. Looking at the website for Dr. Gookin's laboratory, it's about $75-ish, you know, ballpark there. And what is really interesting about how you can submit that, just because I know that submissions is often, you know, making sure you have a good sample, they recommend that you put the sample in a red top tube and just fill it with rubbing alcohol so you can and ship it at any temperature. So it's much more likely to be a viable sample. Time-wise, though, you know, these samples, wherever you send them, they're usually batch. So it's maybe done once a week. So it's going to take longer. And then adding to the cost, then you've also got the shipping fee. And but the sensitivity of this test is significantly better. Now, it is going to be affected by, you know, how fresh is the feces. So if it's diarrhea, then the sensitivity is much better. But if it is older feces or formed feces or a little bit dried out, you know, the sensitivity is going to go down significantly, especially if it's starting to dry out, because Trichomonas really does need a moist environment. However, if it is detected, it is 100% specific. So those are really your differences. And you can use, you know, multiple testing depending on, you know, what the owner can afford. But also, you know, I would say, you know, always use the microscopy, because if you can diagnose this as we did in, you know, immediately, then that can really help on moving toward, you know, treatment and such.
How many times a day do you search for drug information? 100? 200 times? Let's just say it's a lot. Each of those searches can be done in seconds with Plums. And you can trust that the information you find will be accurate and continually updated. And yes, that means no more waiting on the next edition. Plus, Plums has new tools like the Drug Interaction Checker, a first-of-its-kind clinical tool designed to help you make confident decisions when your patient's drug list gets long. See how Plums is trailblazing veterinary support at plums.com. So let's talk a little bit about treatment then. Giardia and Trichic are treated differently. Many antiprotozoal medications like metronidazole are ineffective against Trichomonas fetus. So my understanding is the treatment of choice is ranitidazole, but according to my Plums, we need to compound this medication. There are lots of potential drug interactions, and there's also a warning about possible neurotoxicity. So all of that sounds not so fun. Can you tell us a little bit about this medication? What precautions should clinicians take when they're prescribing this medicine?
Absolutely. So yes, ranitidazole is currently the only drug that is demonstrated to be effective against eliminating Trichomonas fetus from cats. However, it does, as you mentioned, have a narrow safety margin. So once daily dosing, 30 mg per kg is what is recommended. If you move to twice a day, that can increase the likelihood of toxicity. It should not be used in cats that are systemically ill. Generally, cats with Trichomonas fetus, these cats don't feel sick. So if the cat is acting like it's feeling sick, it's probably got something else going on as well. The other thing that you have to keep in mind is because this has a narrow safety margin, if the cat isn't feeling well, you are going to have a hard time telling if it's not feeling well because of the addition of ranitidazole. It also shouldn't be administered to nursing or pregnant cats because we don't really know how this is going to affect the fetus or the young kittens, and also shouldn't be given to very young kittens. The other thing that really has to be thought about is, well, you mentioned the compounding, but this drug has been demonstrated to be carcinogenic in mice, although not, as far as I know, in rats. It is potentially then carcinogenic in people. And so we have to be careful when handling it. So when it's compounded, it is done under a safety hood and it's done safely, but we want to make sure that when it's being prescribed, that people aren't handling it in ways that could expose them potentially. So we want to make sure that, you know, clients and are wearing disposable gloves while handling both the drug, but also the waste of the treated patients. It is recommended to double bag the feces and throw it in the trash, not generally flush it down the toilet. And then because this is often given in capsules, the capsule should be given whole and then and not crushed or opened in any way. And then hands should be washed after handling, as with, you know, really any handling of the patient in this case.
So with a medication like that, where we have a narrow safety margin, you know, I always wonder, should we make sure we absolutely have a definitive diagnosis before prescribing that medication? Or is it ever okay to use this medication as a diagnostic trial?
I would say absolutely not. There's a couple of things that with regard to that. It's the narrow safety margin, which I've already mentioned. But the other thing is there's already been resistance being recognized. And given that we also only have this one medication that is treating Trichomonas fetus, we want to make sure we're using it wisely. So both in regards to the safety margin and the increasing resistance that has already been recognized. And talking about that safety margin, you know, so veterinarians are going to have to advise owners to monitor for neurotoxicity in these patients. So ataxia, you know, first of all, lethargy, anorexia, tremors, nystagmus, agitation. I mean, there's a whole list, but are they identifying any of these? And if so, then really the drug needs to be withdrawn. The neurotoxicity, the side effects are usually reversible, but you need to withdraw that and then treat the animal supportively.
So My understanding is that unlike Giardia, Trichick doesn't really survive for prolonged periods of time in the environment. And you had mentioned earlier that it really needs that moist, environment in the feces and in order to identify it. Do we need to do any type of environmental decontamination or isolation protocols when we're treating this infection in cats?
Yeah. And so resolving Trichomonas infection, especially in multi-cat households and high-density environments specifically, can be really challenging. So this is a fragile organism and whose lifespan outside the body is normally less than an hour, but it can be considerably longer in moist stools. You know, I've seen variable reports. Generally, I think about it as being it can live up to 24 hours, but really there have been occasional reports that say, you know, if you've got some really moist feces, it may even last several days. So the key here again is that it needs that moist area. The lack of the hardiness has to do with it doesn't form the cyst like Giardia does, and it doesn't like the presence of oxygen. So if Trichomonas fetus dries out, or if it's refrigerated, or if it experiences, you know, high temperatures, I think it's generally, you know, greater than 105 degrees Fahrenheit, it will die. So, you know, you can use these, the big thing is cleaning surfaces, making sure that everything is dry. One of the things that's interesting, I thought, well, there's a paper that looked at slugs and that it Trichomonas fetus can survive the intestinal tract of slugs, which could be a source of infection. But just getting back on point, while there is no direct evidence of infection from sharing of food or water bowls, we know that it can survive in these moist areas. So in general, cats that test positive should be isolated. You know, litter boxes, food, water dishes, these need to be disinfected, you know, really washed, dried frequently. And then especially in high density environments, you know, you isolate those cats, but in the environment as a whole, there's really been no disinfection measures that have been shown to be really effective beyond increasing the number of square feet in a facility. That doesn't mean we do them. Of course, we want to make sure that, you know, we're practicing good hygiene and such, but it's these high density areas that are really concerning in with regard to the organism and its ability to survive in that environment. And, you know, because cats, even if we treat them, now, what I didn't mention, I don't think, is that ranitidine can resolve the clinical signs, but the cats potentially could remain subclinically infected. Some may clear it, but many may not. And so if they're living in with multiple cats, you know, this also doesn't mean that if they did clear it, they could get reinfected. So it can become a big problem in that in regard to that.
What kind of testing do you recommend following up with after treatment? Since some animals, you know, as you said, clinically, their diarrhea resolves, they're doing better, but they may still carry the organism.
Generally, PCR is recommended. And so like for this case, we followed up with testing, and I think just for cost-wise, we did a culture, but generally you can do PCR, which is much, much more sensitive. The problem is that informed feces, it's not going to be as sensitive a test. So even if you get a negative, it doesn't mean that they aren't carrying it. Sequential testing is generally recommended, but it is something that we're very aware that can stay in the, you know, cattery shelters, those high density areas for a significant period of time. So something else that I do want to mention, these cats, even, you know, without treatment, their clinical signs will generally resolve within about 2 years. Now, a lot of people aren't going to want to wait that long, and, you know, because especially if they are having fecal incontinence, you know, and so if you've got an multiple cats, you know, so this really can be a problem, much more so in many ways for the owner, because often these cats aren't sick. But even if they clear the diarrhea, they are typically going to be carriers of the organism. So they can relapse in times of stress.
That's good to know, and especially to be able to warn owners about that in the future. So the The kitty in your case was ultimately adopted out, and you did have some follow-up and was doing really well, as I understand.
Yeah, so this was a great outcome. Now, you know, we purposely adopted her as a single cat, so that she would not be putting potentially other cats at risk, even though we had a negative test, you know, 2 weeks after she finished her treatment and the diarrhea resolved. And then on the 6-month follow-up, there had been no recurrence of diarrhea. So great. We can't say for sure that she'll never have it again. And the owner is aware of that, but they are also aware that they aren't going to or shouldn't get other cats.
Well, congratulations on a successful outcome in this case. Before we wrap up, there was one more topic I wanted to just touch on. You mentioned in the article that this species of Trichomonad can cause reproductive disease in cattle, but the isolates are genetically distinct. I was wondering, can humans be infected with this organism?
So generally, we don't think of this as a pathogenic organism for humans. That said, there have been rare reports of Trichomonas fetus infecting humans. Now, what's interesting is there's a couple of papers that I've seen that say, you know, there's been one report of a human being infected, and then they go on to explain different cases. So there are, you know, I'm going to say it's very rare. And the reports that there are all immunocompromised people. So no, we don't think of it as a human pathogen, but we should keep in mind that, you know, we want to practice good hygiene, you know, always wear gloves when we're handling not only, you know, cleaning feces, litter boxes, but also bedding, because potentially there is some feces, you know, fresh feces that dribbled there. So making sure we're handling and keeping the area appropriately sanitized and cleaned and such.
That's good advice. Thanks so much. Well, that was all of the questions that I had about Trichomonas fetus today, although I know you've been on our program before, so you know we end up with our little would you rather game. Are you ready to answer a few more would you rather questions?
All righty. Shoot them at me.
Okay. All right. Would you rather be able to understand what your patients are saying, or would you rather your patients be able to understand you?
Oh, I'd rather understand what they're saying.
Okay. Would you rather continue practicing medicine but have to give up teaching, or would you rather continue teaching but not be able to practice?
Oh, gosh, I don't think I could ever give up medicine, because, you know, I'm going to say you can always make every area of medicine part of teaching. So, yeah.
That's a good answer.
Because I do love doing
college. That was a mean one. I'll make the other ones easier for you. Okay. Would you rather manage an outbreak of upper respiratory disease in a pride of lions, or would you rather manage an outbreak of gastrointestinal disease in a herd of elephants?
I think elephants. I'd be a little bit intimidated by the lions.
Okay. That seems like it would be a lot of poo, but yep.
Yeah.
All right. And finally, if cats and dogs wore leg warmers, would they wear them just on the back legs or on all four legs?
Oh, I think they'd look cute with all four.
Me too. Thanks again for joining us today, Dr. Pullman. This has been a really wonderful conversation.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks again to today's guest for joining us. And thank you for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. While you're there, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review us. You can also listen to our podcast on our website at cliniciansbrief.com/podcasts. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Clinicians Brief, and on Instagram at clinicians.brief, or drop us a line at podcast@briefmedia.com. Clinicians Brief the Podcast is a Brief Media production, produced by Alexis Ussery, sound by Randall Stupka, and hosted by me, Dr. Alyssa Watson.